Okay, it was called the Public Safety and Public Safety and Crime Prevention Committee to order and start out with roll call, please.
Representative Cornish?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Considine?
Here.
Representative Dean? Representative Hertas? Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Howe?
Here.
Representative Lohmer?
Here.
Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Neuberger?
At your service.
Representative O'Neill?
Here.
Representative Quam?
Present.
Representative Rosenthal?
Here.
Representative Schoen? Representative Ward?
Here.
Representative Winkler? And Representative Zerwas.
And notes are from yesterday, which would be... All right, a quorum being present, accept the motion to approve the meeting minutes from January 20th. Anybody would like to? Representative Lohmer moves the minutes. Without any additions or corrections, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, minutes approved. And we'll get on into our agenda. And today we're going to hear from the judicial branch. Who would like to start out? If you wanted to introduce yourself and name and title, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Shorba, and I am the State Court Administrator for the Minnesota Judicial Branch. And this morning, I want to give you an overview of the judicial branch, its mission, structure, and workload, and then talk a little bit about major initiatives that we have going on in the branch. For those of you who are not familiar with it, the judicial branch mission is to provide justice through a system that assures equal access for the fair and timely resolution of cases and controversies. We take this mission very seriously since the requirement for timely resolution stems from the Minnesota Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 of the Minnesota Constitution ensures a remedy for all injuries or wrongs to persons, property, or character promptly and without delay. As you can see on this slide, the Constitution commands that every case we handle, not just criminal cases, but every case be handled promptly and without delay. We believe that justice delayed is justice denied, and so we work very hard to make sure that our cases are handled efficiently, which I'll talk about a little bit later in the presentation. Some background to carry out this constitutional mission. The judicial branch has 315 judges, approximately 2,500 employees, about 10% fewer than we had in fiscal year 09 when we started having a financial crisis and budget reductions. We handle about 1.5 million cases a year. We operate in 99 locations with an annual general fund budget of $300 million. It may be interesting to note from a geographic perspective, the judicial branch operates in more places throughout the state than any other part of state government, so we cover a lot of territory. It's also important to point out that while the court's budget is approximately $300 million, we collect almost $100 million each year, which is sent to counties, municipalities, and the state government. Our organizational structure, Minnesota has a streamlined three-tier structure of two appellate courts and a single trial court called the district court. This graphic shows you how our operations are organized. We're organized into 10 judicial districts for administrative purposes. These districts also serve as the election district for judges. We have two single county judicial districts, the second in Ramsey and the fourth in Hennepin, and the other eight are multi-county districts, ranging from four counties up in the sixth district in the northeast part of the state, to the largest district, which is the ninth, with 17 counties, and as you can see, it covers nearly a quarter of the state in the ninth judicial district. The districts are important for election purposes for our judges. All judges in Minnesota are elected to six-year terms. Supreme Court and Court of Appeals judges are elected statewide, and district court judges run in their respective judicial districts. In order to fill a vacancy on the district court, they're filled by the governor based on recommendations of the Judicial Selection Commission, and that is required by statute for filling trial court vacancies. The Selection Commission is made up of 49 members, 27 appointed by the governor, and 22 appointed by the Supreme Court. Midterm vacancies for appellate judges are also filled by the governor. The governor can voluntarily use the Judicial Selection Commission if he chooses to fill those appellate vacancies. It's not required by statute. If we have complaints about judges, they're handled by an independent 10-person board on judicial standards. All of those members are appointed by the governor. The board can recommend that a judge be reprimanded, suspended, or removed from office, and those recommendations go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has the ultimate authority on all judicial sanctions for judges. In terms of our branch administrative structure, the Chief Justice is the head of the judicial branch and responsible for its overall management. In 2005, in Minnesota, we transitioned to full state funding of the Minnesota Judicial Branch, and we instituted a new administrative structure called the Judicial Council. My office, the State Court Administrator's Office, serves as staff to our Judicial Council, and we provide central administrative infrastructure for the Judicial Branch. The Chief Justice, of course, leads the Supreme Court and continues to have authority for the regulation of the practice of law, statewide rules of procedure. There's a Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals who is appointed by the governor to a 3-year term, who serves as the head of the Court of Appeals. And then there's a Chief Judge in each judicial district who is elected for a 2-year term by their peers on the bench. And they are assisted by judicial district administrators and then county court administrators out in our 87 counties. The Judicial Council is the single statewide policymaking body for the judicial branch. They're responsible for making all administrative policies that guide the operations of the branch. 25 members serve on the Judicial Council, 15 trial court judges, 4 appellate judges, and 6 court administrators from around the state. The Chief Justice serves as the chair, and the council meets on a monthly basis to set the direction for the judicial branch. A little bit about the numbers in terms of our case filings. The district court is where the bulk of our work is done. 289 judges, nearly all of the 1.5 million cases are filed in the district court level. This slide outlines some of the types of cases that are heard by district court judges. There are also conciliation court divisions where you can hear civil disputes up to $15,000 in the trial court. This graph gives you a little bit of an idea about the workload. Of the 1.5 million cases, 12%, or about 187,000, represent the major cases filed, such as felony and gross misdemeanor, criminal, civil, probate, family, and juvenile cases. The remaining 88% of the cases are minor cases, such as conciliation, traffic, parking, misdemeanor cases. As you can see, the majority of the cases are in that minor category, but those 12% of the major cases really take up the bulk of the work in terms of time for the district courts. You can see here the breakdown of those major cases in our family, probate, civil, juvenile, and criminal areas. Nearly half of the trial court's caseload is criminal and juvenile together, followed by family at 23%, civil at 20%, and probate at a little over 8%. So those major cases take up the bulk of the work at the trial court level. Court of Appeals, here's appeals from, of course, district court decisions. Also the Department of Employment and Economic Development, which would be your unemployment appeals, come to the Court of Appeals, as well as other administrative agency decisions. 19 judges serve on the Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals judges serve in 3 judge panels in your cases, not only here in St. Paul, but across the state. Also, judges in the Court of Appeals would hear actions called writs of mandamus or prohibition, which is orders to take a case out of a district court, would go to the Court of Appeals. You can see their filings, about 2,300 filings in 2013, which is the last year we have full statistics, with civil and criminal making up the biggest category of cases, over half of the appeals filed at the Court of Appeals level. And then finally, the highest court in our state, the Supreme Court, with seven justices. They hear appeals from the Court of Appeals, the Tax Court, and the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, which are both executive branch courts. They also, by statute, hear appeals in all first-degree murder cases. They bypass the Court of Appeals and go directly to the Supreme Court. They have original jurisdiction for legislative election contests, and as I mentioned earlier, all judicial and attorney discipline goes to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court also has the responsibility for regulating the practice of law, which I'll mention in a minute here. The Supreme Court filings, direct appeals, meaning those election contests, first degree cases, etc., about 100, a little over 100 in 2013, and then petitions for further review, 671 in 2013. This is where someone will ask the Supreme Court to take a case from the Court of Appeals or elsewhere, and the Supreme Court will look at the facts and precedent of the case and determine whether or not to take that particular case or not and hear it. The regulation of the practice of law is also done by the Supreme Court through a variety of boards. The Lawyers Professional Responsibility Board oversees and administers the attorney discipline system, makes recommendations on attorney discipline to the Supreme Court. The Client Security Fund was established to reimburse clients who suffer loss of money or other property from the dishonest conduct of their attorney. This fund is administered by this board. All of them serve without compensation as public service. The Board of Law Examiners administers the process to license attorneys to practice law in Minnesota, so they'll conduct background checks, administer the bar examinations. And then the Board on Continuing Legal Education certifies courses which attorneys can take to meet the requirements for continuing education in the field of law. So all of those boards report to the Supreme Court and regulate the practice of law. Accountability, we take our performance measures very seriously and have a number of goals that we measure on a regular basis to make sure that we are performing as effectively and efficiently as possible. You can see these core goals, access to justice, that we're open and affordable, timeliness, resolving those cases as part of our mission in a timely manner, integrity and accountability, accurate, complete, and timely records that we maintain, excellence, making decisions that are fair, reasonable, understandable, and that resolve the controversy at issue, fairness and equity, meaning due process and equal protection for all who come forward to the courts, and then a quality court workplace environment for our employees and judges. We have established through the Judicial Council timing standards for all of those goals that we measure and discuss with the Judicial Council twice a year. If you go to our Judicial Branch website, you can see our annual performance measures report, which measures how we're doing on each of those goals, as well as our annual operations report, which are both published on our website on a annual basis. So I encourage you to look at those if you're interested in further detail. Now I want to talk a little bit about some of our ambitious redesign agenda that we're going through in the court system, some of the major efforts that we're undertaking. Our largest is what we call eCourt Minnesota. It's really the centerpiece of our redesign and probably the biggest transformation of the court system in its 150-year history. It's an effort to replace paper-based court files with an electronic information environment. We undertook it to provide the type of convenient online services that customers and the public expect in this day and age, and have three major goals. One is customer service, convenience, and access. We believe that our customers should no longer have to worry in all cases about coming directly to a courthouse, finding parking, getting into the building, but really should be able to file documents and review documents 24/7, just like we do in other major industries right now. We have currently expanded access, and I'll talk a little bit more about how we've done that, but it is certainly one of our major goals. The other is efficiency, that judges and court staff have the electronic tools to manage and process electronic court documents, which we hope will increase efficiency and workflow so that we can automate more of our routine administrative tasks in the court system. And then that law enforcement, county attorneys, public defenders, other government partners will have the way to access information again electronically so they will have also more convenience.
Mr. Shorvin?
Yes.
Just a question. You don't have to give it back to me right now, but can you give me an update before you come back again on the problem that I had with the State Patrol and the e-citations?
I certainly can.
Okay, go ahead.
I have a phone call tomorrow on that, and I'll give you an update on it.
Representative Hillstrom, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shorba, so as the court is going to more and more electronic documents, what about everybody else that's in the courtroom? We see a lot of pro se defendants. What about having the ability to access the information, either by defense counsel, prosecutors, as well as pro se litigants?
Mr. Shorba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we are making a lot of progress on that. We now have Wi-Fi capability in all of our courthouses. We've changed some of our rules and procedures so that especially attorneys can bring in computers, phones, other kinds of things that may not have been allowed so that they can access documents. We're working on the pro se person issue that probably, as we roll out eCourt, will be probably the last because it creates the most difficulties. But we've done some surveying of pro se litigants, and many of them say if they had the ability to access documents electronically, they'd like to do it electronically. So we're working on some additional tools for them to be able to do that, whether that's self-generated forms that are easily read in an electronic environment, things that can be filled out online and generated and sent to the court electronically so you don't have to generate paper. So we're trying to develop most of the tools for the public, but also some of the tools for our judges as well from the bench.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillsburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So here's what I envision. You do e-citations, you do e-charging. The defendant is in custody. Does someone then from the court print out the document to serve the defendant sitting in the jail a copy of what he's charged with? Or I just am trying to figure out how that actually is going to work in practice so that pro se defendants or people who are in custody actually have those documents.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that is how it's done right now. The court will print out the paper so that it can be given to the defendant, whether they're in custody or walking out of the courtroom. There may be the day where we could send it electronically, send an email. The public defender would get it. Other people in the courtroom would get it. But right now, we are still generating that final piece of paper when somebody leaves the courtroom or is still in custody and needs that piece of paper.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually had a follow-up, Mr. Shorban, the same question, more in the civil context. I guess that's, you know, marking the difference in our careers, Representative Hillstrom. There are obviously a lot of pro se litigants in the civil side. We have conciliation court, and we have this basic concept that people should be able to get in and have access to justice. Will e-filing, I assume, would not apply to conciliation court, but you may correct me if I'm wrong. And number two, it seems to me that you should have a non-electronic option, perhaps for people who are not I can see requiring all members of the bar to use the e-filing. Anybody who's a lawyer should learn the electronic system well enough to access the courts. But people operating on their own, it seems to me, should be able to send something in the mail.
Mr. Shorber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, that's exactly the direction that we're going. When we mandate e-filing, which I'll talk a little bit about when those dates are coming, it'll be only for members of the bar. Pro se litigants would still be able to file things via paper. That's at least our plan right now. We'll see as technology advances and people's skill advance. There may be a time when we move forward with more mandatory for those, but that's not our goal right now.
Okay, follow-up.
In conciliation court, is that still a paper system in your plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, since most of the people there are pro se, it would still be paper. If it's an attorney who's filing something in conciliation court, they would still be required to file it electronically.
And Mr. Chair, Shorba, the last question is, can the referees in conciliation court manage the electronic system? There's a lot of people who kind of come through there and are not obviously at the level of sophistication of a judge and don't have the staff and so forth. That seems like that's a system that might not be as well suited to it, but I'm sure you've got it worked out somehow.
Mr.
Chair, Representative Winkler. As you'll see in the slide coming up, training is a huge part of this rollout, and we are doing a lot of training with our own staff as well as our judges and referees to provide ways that they can operate the system most effectively. So we've actually created new software that'll link to our case management system that'll allow a judge and others on the bench to be able to do some touchscreen things and other things to be more effective. So that is a major part of our effort training.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler touched on the issue that I had. In greater Minnesota, you have a lot of areas that don't have broadband and have a tough time even getting internet service. So it's fortunately, you're going to keep the paper trail going for a while until those issues can be resolved. The other issue I have is the security systems on the programs. We have a lot of hackers that are trying to get in. In fact, we had our college systems that were broken into in the past couple weeks. Mm-hmm. I'm just want to make sure that you're doing the proper security issues on it so it restricts the access to people who shouldn't be there.
Mr. Short.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that's certainly been a major part of our effort, the infrastructure to not only provide the security, but also as we become more and more reliant on the electronic environment to make sure that all the lines that run to greater Minnesota can carry the information and have less downtime. So we have spent a lot of time on infrastructure, so your concern has been hopefully dealt with very well. But thank you for your comment.
Okay. Mr. Schorber, go ahead.
So just a little bit about a history of eCourt. We began in 2010 with a civil e-filing pilot in Hennepin County, which was joined by Ramsey in 2011. And then 9 additional pilot counties were chosen in 2012 to test out eCourt around the state, some large, some small. Those counties, those 11 now pilot counties, became mandatory for civil and family e-filing in 2012. So in civil and family cases in those 11 counties, if you're an attorney filing one of those cases, you need to file it electronically through our system. And then in 2013, the remaining pilots joined them. So it's been a test. We've tried to phase in this project to see how it's worked. We've learned things from our pilots. And now we'll be going further this year. It's a big year for eCourt. In July, it'll be mandatory for all case types to file electronically in those 11 counties. In July through December, we're going to do sort of a soft rollout of voluntary e-filing in other parts of the state. So attorneys and others will be trained on how to use the system, and they can voluntarily try filing those documents electronically. And then 2016, July, is our plan to become mandatory e-filing in all counties across the state, which is where we'll gain hopefully the most efficiencies and not be creating paper files as well as electronic files. The appellate courts are also going through the e-court effort. Phase one includes e-filing for criminal appeals originating in Ramsey County, where the parties are represented by either the county attorney's office or public defenders. Additionally, the Department of Employment and Economic Development began e-filing administrative records for unemployment appeals. And our expansion later this month will include criminal appeals from Hennepin County and administrative records from other executive branch agencies. The spring of 2015 is when we hope to go e-filing the appellate cases for private attorneys who are filing appeals. Other changes that are going on along with eCourt to make it more effective. Court rules revisions. We had 7 rules committees meeting all fall to look at how rules might need to change in this new electronic environment. Recommendations from the advisory committees were made to the Supreme Court in December. You can see those rule changes on our website. Comments close at the beginning of March if you have any interest in commenting on those proposed rules. E-access, determining how our partners and others will gain access to information is certainly a big part of this effort. So right now we are rolling out to government agencies the ability to access certain documents electronically that they need to do their business. Document imaging, right now in the paper world, when a piece of paper comes in, our court staff are imaging that document so it's retained in our system electronically. Which means for our customers right now, if you want to see a case document that was filed in Bemidji and you live here in St. Paul, you can go to the St. Paul Courthouse, get online on our computer and see documents from all over the state. So it's created gradually some greater access. And then, of course, as I mentioned, training, not only for our own staff and judges, but for others around the state who are going to be interacting with our system. So a major, huge initiative, and this will be a big year for finalizing some of the rollouts of eCourt. The other initiative I want to touch on is changes in our service delivery through drug courts. Drug courts and other problem-solving courts have expanded around the state. Right now we have 50 drug courts operating, which provide services in 57 counties across the state. In 2014, we opened 9 new drug court programs across the state. This was possible through increased funding from the legislature, as well as some grants from the Department of Traffic Safety. These courts are really specialized calendars within the trial courts, using the power of the court, the influence of the judge, frequent drug testing, ongoing treatment, court check-ins, to try to operate in a little bit different way to make people accountable and also to hopefully make people successful in dealing with some of their addictions. Drug courts have been studied across the country and have been very thoroughly studied here in Minnesota. In 2012, we had an evaluation of our drug courts, which was filled in a little bit more. In 2014, it showed that those who went through drug courts were less likely to reoffend. They spent less time incarcerated, reducing costs to taxpayers, and show gains in employment, educational achievement, home, rental ownership, and payment of child support. In addition to our own studies, others have studied these courts. Most recently, 2014, the outside agency of traffic safety studied our DWI courts, and this evaluation found that they reduced recidivism, that completion rates were well above the national average. In Minnesota, completion rates in our 9 DWI courts were 65% to 86%, with the national average being 53%. 6 of the 7 programs that were included in a cost analysis showed cost savings due to reduced recidivism for DWI court participants. So there has been a lot of studies, again, things you can find on our website, talking about the success of these courts here in Minnesota.
Mr. Sharbin?
Yes.
I have a couple of questions here. Mm-hmm. First, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Sharbin, do we now have every area having at least access to a, you call them all drug courts, but specialty courts, or are we still having gaps, and are they in greater Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we are still having gaps. I think the latest number, if I'm not mistaken, is about almost 60% of the population having access to one of these courts, but there are still spots throughout the state that do not have an operating problem-solving court with people not having access. We have some planning going on right now as to how we might be able to fill that gap through using sort of multi-county kinds of courts, so that even though a population in a small county is not enough to justify economically a drug court or problem-solving court, they can maybe work with other counties to do a multi-county approach. So we've got some planning going on with that, and of course at some point we'll be talking with the legislature about that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vilsner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an area that I care about very much. So there are a number of specialty courts that exist that are not approved by the Judicial Council. Is every court now that wants to exist allowed to exist, or are you not allowed to exist if you don't get approval of the Judicial Council? I'm just trying to figure out kind of some of these. You know, we have a veterans court in Anoka that's not one of these listed. There's the one out of St. Cloud, which is a domestic violence, which isn't one that's listed. I'm just curious as to how many of those are there out there, and is there a process for people to get those approved or not?
Mr. Sherman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I think right now there are 3 operating that have not been approved by the Judicial Council. We encourage all those courts to come through the council because there are some best practices that we want to make sure are working in those particular courts. Some start up sort of on their own. Maybe the county attorney or one judge decide that they want to sort of put something into practice. The Judicial Council encourages them to all come through the formal approval process, and any funds that we administer from the legislature or otherwise are not provided to any court that is not formally approved. So anything you can do to encourage them to come through the process, we'd like to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are there any that have tried to come through that process that have not been approved?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, no.
Sure.
Sometimes they've had to do some changes and some tweaks to their program to make sure they're consistent with our standards and the national standards, but we have not denied anyone authority to operate.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so then once they're approved, do they get money, or is there a separate application process for getting some of the money?
Mr. Shorbit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilsman, when we had new funding from the legislature last session, we went through an advertising and approval process. So we advertised the funding. Courts that were ready to operate and wanted to operate it came through a process through our Drug Court Initiative Advisory Committee, and then final approval by the Judicial Council. And the Judicial Council allocated those funds to courts that were interested in operating.
One final question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dilsman.
Thank you. And Mr. Shorbit, are we doing anything to actually encourage other areas to come up with specialty courts, or do they kind of just have to do it on their own and then come to the Judicial Council? Or are we providing training if somebody wanted to start a drug court? Do we kind of have a set training that they could come to, or do they kind of have to go out and get trained and then come back and get approved?
Mr. Shorbit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilsman, we do have a process for getting courts ready if courts are interested. On a number of occasions, we've brought national trainers to Minnesota so that courts that are interested can go through the training. You have to bring your partners with you, prosecutor, public defenders, and others, so that if we were to get additional funding or if there was grant money available from the federal government, courts would be ready to operate. So we do that training in advance.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, one last question.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Shorbit. So are there any other areas other than kind of in criminal law that you're looking at specialty courts, whether it's in the family area or, you know, I know we do some of like the early neutral evaluations, but I don't think you actually call those specialty courts. Are you looking at other areas to expand courts into the civil side?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, yes. As you can see, we have three mental health courts that are operating, mostly in the urban area, trying to deal with those individuals who frequently come through the court system who have mental health needs, so trying to tie them in with service providers and others to help deal with their mental health addiction, which can lead to behavior, whether that's criminal or other misdemeanor behavior. Family Dependency Court is a juvenile court docket where selected neglect, abuse, dependency cases are identified where parents and others may have substance abuse issues. So those family dependency courts help to try to deal through the abuse with those who have substance abuse issues that can be contributing to it. And then the veterans courts, most of that deals with criminal behavior, but some of it deals with non-criminal behavior as well. And again, we have five of those operating in the state.
Okay, I've got question here, and we have a couple members. More of a comment than anything for the new members. This is one of the things that we'll struggle with is the specialty courts. We've already have, I think, one bill coming to our committee asking for extra money for specialty courts. It's kind of like all day, every day, kindergarten, or anything else. It starts out with a few people doing it, and then sometimes it's expected that it's going to grow from our funding in the legislature. And I'm a big supporter of the specialty courts. I've been to a number of them, graduation, vets course, drug course, UWI course. But how many we can fund, and it's like public defenders. They want more public defenders to help with the backlog of cases, and they love to give them everything they want. But we're going to have so many priorities to look over and get together and knock our heads together to find out which one, if we get extra money, to fund. So that'll be part of our struggle. Even though something seems like an excellent deal, sometimes we just can't afford it, or can. We'll have to see. Representative O'Neill, followed by Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Chair. And I'm right on the same page as Representative Hilstrom, and I've toured several of these courts as well. I think I've only missed one so far, and with my background, it's incredibly interesting, and it seems very compelling. And just wondering, thank you for explaining the family dependency. That was one that I had missed, but I have been to all the other ones. Could you explain, or do you know how many cases they're currently serving right now in the 50 courts?
Mr. Shorbit.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I don't have that off the top of my head. We do keep track of how many participants go through each level of court, so we could certainly gather that data for our most recent annual and tell you how many have gone through. That would be helpful.
It would.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. It would be very helpful, and then also to know how many are currently, since we just did a very significant expansion, and you know, how many are currently being served. And I know that it takes a long time for them to process through, and that's part of the beauty of it, really, is to make sure that they have long-term plans. plans and, you know, much, it just seems to be quite effective. So if you could find out, too, how many are actually currently being served and, you know, I, especially with the expansion and as we look at budgets and everything, kind of looking at the cost effectiveness of the courts, appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got a series of questions throughout the presentation. One of my first questions, can you tell me where the three mental health courts are? And then when you look at a lot of these particular specialty courts, which I agree, I think they've done great wonders, are they not a lot of them cross-topic? I mean, you could have somebody that's a mental health court person but also would be there because of drugs. And so how do you, I realize hybrid is on the list too, which I assume is maybe, can you explain what hybrid is? Because I mean, it seems like many of these could be just put together under one topic as saying this is a intensive specialty court, whatever it may be, and cover a lot of those things.
Mr. Schauber, yeah, that's a good question. Representative Schoen, I've wondered the same thing, why DWI and drug court are separate, if it's a dependency. If maybe you could clarify that for us. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, I'll tackle that first. Hybrid generally involves, as you were sort of alluding to, drug court and DWI court. Some of the ways that these courts operate depends on funding. Some funding come from the legislature. Other fundings come from mostly federal government grants. And so you may start a mental health court because you're getting funding from the Department of Human Services or Health and Human Services or other places. So that can lead a little bit to some of the siloing that goes on. But generally, the hybrid courts are DWI and drug courts. The mental health courts right now are operating in Ramsey and Hennepin, and I'm blanking on the third place. Oh, Janet is looking for the third. Those are the two. They started mostly in Hennepin and Ramsey.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so this is my first time on the judiciary side since they're combined this year. So this just came to me. I probably could have asked this when I was actually in the job. But when you are talking about when you're working with the judges – and determining, you know, more administrative things, because one of the things that I used to run into is when I'd write search warrants in for a different judicial district than we officed in. So at first it started out, if I wanted to do a search warrant in Scott County when I was on a task force, I'd have to drive over to Scott County to do it, even though I could have driven down to Hastings because it's in the same judicial district. Then later we were able to get, oh, okay, you can do it anywhere in the judicial district. Can you explain to me how these decisions are arrived at? Because, I mean, being a judge is a pretty good gig because you can do anything you want to, it seems like. And I'm just being honest. So how do you, I mean, because sometimes it gets frustrating, especially on our end in law enforcement, and I think probably prosecutors and defense attorneys, although they wouldn't say out loud because of fear of penalty, judges are employees, too. They're paid by the state. Why can't they work with us a little bit better on some of these issues, and how do we get them to help us out along that lines or work in conjunction when we need... It was such a difficult process to get telephonic warrants, and even when they were okayed, sometimes it took 2-3 years for some judges to accept it. So how is that process dealt with?
Mr. Schauber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen. I'm not going to address the judges can do whatever they want since I'm not one, but...
you shouldn't.
As I mentioned, in 2005, we moved to state funding of the judicial branch. So prior to 2005, the court system, like other parts of county government, was based on county funding, like county attorneys, county auditors, legal counsel, others. So in 2005, we transitioned, and as you can probably be aware, any transition where you're moving from 87 independent operated entities to one state-funded takes a lot of change. And I think we've come a long way since 2005 in terms of standardization. That's really the role of the Judicial Council. The Judicial Council is the policy-making body. The Chief Justice chairs it, and every month when the council meets, we talk about some of the issues that you're raising. How can we standardize things? Why do we do things differently in 10 districts? And I think we've changed a lot of that. I also think the e-court effort is changing much of that. It's hard to have you know, 87 different processes when you have to go through one case management system electronically, and there's only one way to accept documents. So that's helping to change a lot of it. We're standardizing a lot of things as a result of eCourt. But if there are issues that you think are being operated, you know, inconsistently, please bring them to my attention. I'm more than happy to bring, as the chair knows, to bring issues to our judicial counsel or our chief justice to raise them with our counsel.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your explanation. The explanation about the 2005 changeover answers a lot of that question, because it was near that time frame, obviously. And so I appreciate that. I don't have major issues now. I will say from my statement before, I've had 99% great experiences with most of our bench members on those issues. Can you answer any questions related to this? How many judges have actually been disciplined and removed through the the board or the folks that handle that issue? I mean, how many complaints are actually acted upon in a year versus received? And how does that action take place? What does that look like?
Sure.
Is there a public person involved with this, a layperson that's not just a judicial branch? Because in law enforcement, we get this outside scrutiny where they want to have so much of the public involved that maybe don't even understand law enforcement, but they want to be a part of the disciplinary process to review the job we do. How does that happen in the court system?
Mr. Shorbin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, that question might be better addressed to the staff person for the Board on Judicial Standards, but as I mentioned, there's a 10-member board, all appointed by the governor. It's headed by a layperson who's not a judge. It does have a couple judges who are on it who are appointed by the governor. And any complaint about a judge goes to that board, and they are required to investigate those complaints. They are investigations, and the results of those investigations can be private, depending a private reprimand, a public reprimand, suspension, or removal from office. Again, those decisions have to go to the Supreme Court, and when the Supreme Court makes a public reprimand or removes someone from office, it is public, and the Supreme Court will publish those actions. So you sometimes will see something in the paper about attorneys being disciplined or somebody's been disbarred. Same thing is true with judges. So in terms of the data as to how many complaints go to the board and what they do with them, I think the staff person for the board, since they're independent from us, we don't control them, would probably be the better person to ask about that. But it's a good question.
Okay, Mr. Chair, that was more so what I was curious about is how many do they deal with a year, mm-hmm. and then, you know, how many judges have actually been disbarred?
Removed from office?
Removed from bench, yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen.
Maybe in the last 10 years.
In the last 10 years, we'll have to check on this. During my last 10 years, I don't remember anyone removed from office except by election. But I can check for sure. I don't think there has been. There's certainly been other disciplinary actions.
Mr. Shorbin, I've got, I think, three people on the list here. But what's the reality in the judicial council? What actually hammer do they have? How much authority? And the reason I'm asking is I've got a series of things that are going through my mind about the disparity in sentencing. The gun cases in Hennepin County or something, I think, were in the paper recently about how they downward departed quite a bit. And so do you get together and talk about things like this? Because the more that happens, the more problem that the legislature has is trying to fix it, narrowing judges' choices on sentencing. So how do you folks handle disparity? Are the judges completely at will to do, you know, what they want in the sentencing when it is given to them? Or does the rumor circulate and back to the Judicial Council and the head honcho is up the food chain saying, hey, we got a problem down here in X county we need to address? How does that portrait play out?
Mr. Chair, the Judicial Council on a regular basis will look at those kind of, we call them performance measures, about how they're doing with terms of sentencing and disparity and what could be some of the factors behind it in one particular geographic location or another. So they are looking at it, and all of the 10 chief judges of each district serve on the council where those discussions are had. Sentencing, as you probably are aware, is a tricky issue. Judges are independently elected to serve and to make their sort of case adjudication decisions within the law based on the sentencing guidelines and the laws that are set by the legislature. So although the council might raise issues and want to know and look into why some particular part. Maybe it's a county attorney's way of processing cases or charging cases that could have an effect on it. Maybe it's public defender resources. Maybe it's the type of crime that's going on in law enforcement, maybe investigating differently in one part of the state than another. So those are the kind of issues that the council will discuss, but the council does not have authority to tell a judge in individual sentencing cases what to do with their sentence. Does that help?
It might be a good message to take back to them that the more they do that and the more disparity and the more we're upward or down to departures with a lack of consistency tends to the legislature to take a closer look then at mandatory minimums or narrowing the choices. It's just something to think about. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just also supplement the answer to say that, of course, the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court do have review authority over all those kinds of decisions, too. So that is, I mean, it's not a council's job to do that. It's the appellate courts. I have a couple, just a question about the specialty courts in general. My perception is that a lot of the success of these courts depend on the enthusiasm and willingness of individual judges to participate in them and to lead them. And I guess my question is, what kind of longevity do we have as far as judges leaving the bench or rotating to a different assignment and those courts continuing under other judges being assigned into them? Are, you know, as we are putting money towards this innovation, are we able to see them sustain themselves over time, or do they kind of rise and fall depending on the eagerness of a particular judge to weigh into those issues and get more deeply involved in the issues?
Mr. Shorba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, that's a very good question. Getting back to Representative Hillstrom's question, part of that is in the training, because you're right, it is a unique thing to run one of these specialty courts. Luckily, we have a lot of judges who are very enthusiastic about them, just like members of the committee have talked about, and really see them as successful and so want to participate in them. So we haven't had an issue with not being able to find somebody who would want to take them on. But it does require training for the judge, training for the county attorney, public defender, probation, and others to go through it to make sure that they understand how the court works and understand the standards that they need to follow. So we've been doing a lot of sort of succession planning in the training area to make sure that that issue you raised doesn't occur.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Shorba, both Representative Schoen and also Chair Cornish talked on a couple of the issues I was going to ask about. One thing we do have an issue with is sentencing disparity, or the disparity gap in sentencing. And I know from my career in law enforcement and dealing with the courts, anytime there's an upward departure in the sentencing guidelines, the judge is required to do paperwork and explain that departure. I've also have learned in this past summer that when they do downward departures on the sentencing guidelines, that they also have to do that same paperwork. But talking to some people, a lot of times the judges are not doing the downward departure paperwork and with the explanation for the downward departure. I was talking to a county commissioner in one county. A judge did a downward departure on a felony conviction that should have required almost 2 years, did the 364 days, 1 day short of the year mark. The gentleman is has many medical problems. The county is now responsible for those medical problems. In 3 months, the county it's cost the county over $250,000 in medical expenses and other fees, security, transportation, because the judge went below the sentencing guidelines, and it's costing the county and the taxpayers a lot of money. Where if he would have been just added 1 day, he would have been sent to St. Peter, where the proper medical attention would have been fine, would save the county money. The state has the facilities there to deal with it. And it would have cost overall, it would have been a little bit cost of the state, but it wouldn't have been near the cost that the county's paying, and with a lot less people paying for that. What I'm wondering is, with the judges not doing the paperwork for the downward departures, is there any repercussions coming to the judges for failure to do that?
Mr. Shorba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I guess the only thing I could say with regard to that is, as Representative Winkler said, if there's some grounds for an appeal because the judge didn't do something properly in terms of the process, or if there is some inattention to his required duties and you wanted to bring somebody wanted to bring some complaint against him before the board, unfortunately, my office doesn't have any authority to do anything to that particular judge, but those are some options. I don't know the facts of your particular case, but I don't doubt it's true.
And Representative O'Neill, followed by Representative Quam.
Thank you, Chair. back to the drug court and the DUI court evaluations, I'm wondering if you could just give us some of the numbers and, you know, going through the traditional path through the courts versus either the drug court or the DUI court, as far as recidivism rates, what are the differences? And also, you had said here that it saves the taxpayers money. Do you have that quantified at all?
Mr. Sharp.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, we do, and I can certainly talk in more detail about it. The evaluation, particularly of the DWI courts, had a cost analysis included with it. So they actually looked at comparison groups to see how much time did somebody who went through the traditional process spend either in jail or in prison, and how much time did somebody who went through the DWI court. And there was a significant savings. I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I can certainly get that for you. And also the recidivism rates were very significant, significantly reduced for those who went through the DWI court. So the other study looked at recidivism on drug court issues, but it didn't look at the cost analysis. So that's why this one was sort of groundbreaking a little bit in terms of the analysis that was done. So I can certainly provide that either when it comes to talk about our budget request or at some other point to you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, maybe if you could provide it even before the budget talks, because then we can kind of wrap our mind around it and take a real good look at it. And also with that, of course, again, how many that they're serving through that system.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I got that down here. So. And then just, Mr. Chair, the question about mental health courts, Hennepin Ramsey and the other places, St. Louis County in Duluth, where a mental health court is.
Yeah. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm interested in the last judge that was removed, not by election, what was the area or topic for the reason, you know, not specific, and then what was the duration from complaint to removal?
Mr. Jordan.
Information. Mr. Chair, Representative Palm, we can get that information for you for sure.
Okay, that's our question so far. Mr. Shorba, what's the status of the implied consent law right now in Minnesota? Is there an ongoing Supreme Court case? And what's the little background on that, the constitutionality of the implied consent? Is there anything cooking on that right now?
Mr. Chair, I'm probably not the person to answer that question, but I can certainly talk with our commissioner at the Supreme Court to see what the status is. I don't know if Janet has anything more to add. I haven't talked to the court or the commissioner about where the case is. I know the court's reviewing it, but I don't know what the prognosis is for some kind of a decision, and they probably won't.
And then another kind of a broad question, are you the person to ask, or would it be more sentencing guidelines, if there's been any unintended consequences of any laws we've passed within the last couple of years that you folks have had a problem with at the bench? Or anything come to mind?
Mr. Chair, can you explain a little bit more what you might?
Yeah, I mean, anything that comes to mind, unintended consequences of some of the laws that we've passed, when you see those at the bench, anything come to mind right offhand? Or,
Mr. Chair, not to me. If you are looking for either some of the disparities or other issues, probably the sentencing guidelines would be the best to give you the raw data on that. That's where we get it from.
Okay, are there any other questions from the members? Are you done with your? Do you have anything left?
I have one last slide.
Okay.
I just wanted to talk briefly about a few other initiatives. Some of them may be related to some of the questions that were coming forward, especially regarding law enforcement. One is related to e-citations and e-charging. These are allowing law enforcement and prosecutors to automatically transfer citations entered in a squad car, for example, to law enforcement and court databases, as well as allowing prosecutors to charge cases electronically. The other area where we've been making a lot of change has to do with conservators. The conservators appointed by the court to administer the property of elderly and vulnerable adults in our population in the state of Minnesota of those aging is increasing. Today we handle about 8,000. We have about 8,000 conservators, some professional who do it for a living, some who are family members who are handling estates. About $625 million in assets, with the average estate about $100,000. So these people can be particularly vulnerable, so we've tried to change a lot of the ways that we process those conservator accounts, automating some of it, doing more frequent audits to make sure that we are watching out for those who are managing those assets. And then lastly, we have a change being done in our orders for protection system. It's an old, antiquated system. We're making some changes that will increase law enforcement's access to data so that they know if an OFP is out there against somebody, and hopefully will help law enforcement to reduce domestic violence and other kinds of things. And that will be piloted in the next couple of months, rolled out. So just a few other initiatives along with the problem-solving courts and e-courts that I mentioned earlier. Thank you very much.
Yes, Representative Cassidy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to hear that you support the drug courts, and I'm assuming that the majority of your experience with that is the Blue Earth County one. Maybe more. I just would like to point out, though, I've had a lot of clients in the drug court when I was working for the Sheriff's Department. The drug court was able to bring a tremendous amount of resources to those people. For example, I had three women that went into the drug court that were, their drug of choice was methamphetamines, and they didn't have any teeth. And the drug court was able to work with community members and get them teeth. And that was a big thing as far as their self-esteem and part of their recovery. But that is a fundamental difference between drug court and regular court, is the amount of resources that the drug court is able to bring to bear on their rehabilitation.
Yeah, I agree, Representative. Kind of like the Veterans Court, when I sat in on the, not just the court, but the pre-court where they get together in their room, they got somebody that takes care of their records, DD-214s, and their, they make sure they've got their health insurance, they make arrangements with their employer, their transportation. If you take care of a person's watch their spare time and help them get to work and keep a job and their health taken care of, it goes a long way into less recidivism and looking to go out and get in trouble. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question regards opioids and drug courts. I mean, we've seen an escalation of heroin use and things over the past several years. I mean, are they generally handled through the drug courts, or are some of those, you know, to the point that they're kicked to a different court?
Mr. Shorba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, yes, they are handled through drug court. Drug court is equipped to deal with all kinds of different addictions to different kinds of drugs, so they are handled there. One of the best practices for these drug courts is to try to get serious cases into drug court, not just low-level misdemeanors, but felonies as well, because those individuals can be likely to recidivate much more than maybe someone at a lower level. So those cases are going to drug court.
Anybody on the list? Okay, Mr. Shorby, anything else for us today?
Thank you very much. Appreciate the time on the committee's agenda.
Any questions from anybody? If not, we are adjourned until what? We will, anyway. Just a second. I was going to introduce our researcher, Brian Rosenblatt, with a T, right, instead of a D. And if you could just give us a little bit of your background, where you come from.
Sure. I actually came over from the judicial branch. I'm an attorney, went to law school at Hamlin, passed the bar, then went to go clerk for a judge in Lyon County, and then now I'm here.
So I'm happy to be here. From Golden Valley, Minnesota, so it was a little bit of a culture shock for me when I moved to Marshall, but I made it, and here I am.
All right, we're glad to have you. And just for clarification, as a GOP researcher, and then if the GOP members could just stop by my office for just a few minutes right after the meeting. Meeting adjourned.